Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Manning versus the United States. Mr. Beck?
May it please the court. This court in Hoosier Bank Corporation said that plaintiffs who have both a Bivens claim and a Federal Torts Claim Act claim should bring those in a single cause of action. That's what Mr. Manning did here. And then the district court applied Section 2676, the judgment bar, in a way that obliterated the Bivens claim, and, as I will be discussing today, in a way that would obliterate the Bivens claim in virtually any action where a plaintiff followed this court's direction to bring both the Bivens claim and the Torts Claim Act claim in the same action. And the effect of the district court's application of 2676 is illustrated by the general situation that we have here, not getting into particular facts, but the general outline. And that is, we have a Bivens claim and a Federal Torts Claim Act claim brought in the same action, as Hoosier Bank Corp says that we should have done. And we had a Bivens claim that was a winning claim. Again, without arguing the merits of it, it was a claim under Brady, failure to disclose exculpatory evidence, including, in this case, the defendant's agent's own misconduct concerning the falsification.
If you look carefully, you're discussing it with the same panel who wrote the first one. So.
Okay. And, Your Honor, I'm just trying to set the scene. I won't take a lot of time on this. But the pattern that we have is both claims in the same action, a winning Bivens claim, and then a losing Federal Torts Claim Act claim. Here on the ground that that there was probable cause independent of the tainted evidence. And under the district court's application of Section 2676, any judgment, any kind of judgment order along the way during the litigation on the Federal Torts Claim Act would bar any future judgment on the plaintiff's favor under the Bivens action, and would nullify and abrogate any existing judgment order that's been entered in the plaintiff's favor on the Bivens action.
Is your beef based on the retroactivity of the way the judge handled it? Or?
No, it's not, Your Honor. Our beef is that under the statute, when a Bivens claim and a Federal Torts Claim Act claim are brought together under the same action, as this court said we should do in Hoosier Bank Corporation, then 2676 has no application. It should not depend on the fortuity of which judgment order comes first.
Now, the plaintiff, Mr. Beck, moved for judgment, did he not, in the Bivens action?
Yes, moved for judgment and received judgment, yes, but it was not a final appealable judgment.
No, I appreciate that. Would you say we had two claims in one action?
Yes, I'd say we had a Bivens claim and a Federal Torts Claim Act claim in one action.
Now, when you move for judgment in a situation like that and judgment is granted, what do we have left? Do we have still two claims in a single action, even though we have the appealability issue, or do we have one claim in a new action?
I think at that point, Your Honor, we have two claims in a single action, one of which we have an interlocutory judgment order in our favor, but one that could be revisited at any time prior to the entry of a final appealable judgment that disposes of the entire action.
So you would say the moving for judgment really doesn't alter in any way the framework of the action?
That's right, Your Honor. I think that I think that the that it doesn't matter and shouldn't matter under 2676 and Hoosier Bank Corporation and the and Will versus Halleck, the Supreme Court decision. It shouldn't matter what sequence the claims are resolved in if they're brought in a single cause of action. For example, if you had precisely the same facts and precisely the same resolution of the two claims, you could have, as we happen to have here, you could have a verdict on the Bivens claim first, and you could have a judgment order entered after the judge rejects the post-trial motions, and then a year or so later, as it so happened in this case, a judicial decision on the Federal Tort Claim Act. But on the other hand, with exactly the same facts and exactly the same resolution of the two types of claim, you could have, for example, summary judgment granted on the Federal Tort Claim Act on the ground that there's no material fact as to probable cause, and then an exact same type of verdict on the Bivens action. You could have a judgment entered at the close of plaintiff's case on the Federal Tort Claim Act with the jury impaneled. You could have a judgment entered at the close of all the evidence. You could have a judgment entered on the Federal Tort Claim Act while the jury's deliberating. Or you could have a judgment on the Federal Tort Claim Act after the jury's returned the verdict, but before the judge has disposed of the post-trial motions and entered a judgment order on that verdict. And what we submit is that the fortuity of the timing of the resolution of the two claims when brought in a single cause of action should not determine the outcome. And interestingly, the district court said that it agreed with that proposition. The district court said that the fortuity of the timing of the judgments should not determine it, and yet, under the scheme adopted by the district court, the fortuity of the timing is what determines whether a Bivens action is extinguished. And it worked this way. What the district judge said, well, 2676 applies where both claims are brought in a single action. We disagree with that. We think it's contrary to the language of the statute. But and the judge seemed to recognize that the problem there is that in the normal course, and he also said, and we don't disagree with this, incidentally, if they were in separate actions, that a Federal Tort Claim Act decision could, in fact, bar further pursuit of a separate Bivens action. But then what the judge went on, so the judge recognized.
Excuse me, just a minute. You said you agreed with that?
We don't disagree that if you had a pending Bivens action,
right,
and you had a pending Federal Tort Claim Act action, and let's say the Bivens action had been brought first, we don't disagree with the proposition that a judgment on the Federal Tort Claim Act would bar further pursuit, a final judgment on the Federal Tort Claim Act would bar further pursuit of the Bivens action. But what this court was getting at, I believe, in Hoosier Bank Corporation, is to respect the concerns with duplicative litigation that underlie 2676, and yet also to respect the fact that plaintiffs have a significant interest in vindicating their constitutional rights through a Bivens action. The solution is not to bring these separate actions, but to bring the claims in the same action. And that way...
Or not to bring the Federal Tort Claims Act at all.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, although the Supreme Court and the agents say, well, that's the solution to the problem. But the Supreme Court says no, that those actions are complementary and parallel, and the Supreme Court, way back in 1980, explained why a Federal Tort Claim Act action is not an adequate substitute for a Bivens action. Now, it's true that someone could forego the Federal Tort Claims Act action, but and that would be, you know, one option that a plaintiff would have.
Essentially, your total complaint is against the officers involved, and so it's a Bivens action.
Yes.
The Tort Claims Act strikes me as being a throwaway line anyway.
Well, except that there's always the problem that the government might not indemnify the agents, and the agents might be essentially judgment-proof. And the United States has seen fit to waive sovereign immunity on those kind of torts, and so a plaintiff ought not to be put in a position of having to waive a claim that the United States has granted it. Now, if... And there's certainly no reason to do that when the proper construction of the judgment bar would allow for two claims to proceed simultaneously if brought in the same cause of action. And I submit, Your Honors, that that's the real point of Hoosier Bank Corporation, that in order to avoid this problem of the judgment bar precluding a Bivens action, the court said, bring those two claims together in one cause of action. And then when you read the language of the statute, it talks about barring actions, not claims.
What if the district judge in such a setting, Mr. Beck, acts with dispatch on the Tort Claims Act? What would you think Congress had in mind? You bring both claims in the suit and a district court judge moves with dispatch before the trial of the Bivens claim.
And, Your Honor, what I would say...
returns a verdict in a Bivens claim.
On the Federal Tort Claims Act. I would say, Your Honor, that under the proper construction of the statute, where you brought them both in one claim, then that ruling would not preclude a trial and judgment on the Bivens action, and that... because there wouldn't be a final judgment disposing of the Federal Tort Claims Act. There would be an interlocutory, reviewable judgment, and the interlocutory disposition of that claim wouldn't trigger the statute, which talks about barring actions, not other claims within the same action.
Is there anything in the Seventh Circuit precedent that you cite to us, and of course the Supreme Court, language, which would preclude the conclusion that you're at risk by doing that? In other words, what we find ourselves with in this case is that you certainly have, you know, both avenues open, but what plain reading would preclude that conclusion, that what resulted here was an inevitable result of strategic choice?
If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, I don't think that any Supreme Court case, any Seventh Circuit case, or any case anywhere else, for that matter, has dealt with the situation that we have here, where, number one, we've got the Halleck opinion that from the Supreme Court says that you can maintain these claims simultaneously, and that disposes of a lot of the precedent that the agents rely on. Number two, after Hoosier Bank Corp., where this court said the proper procedure is to bring them in the same cause of action, and then three, where they've actually been brought in the same cause of action. So this is the first time that we're aware of that the stars have aligned where those three conditions are present. So there's, to answer your first question, Your Honor, there's no Supreme Court precedent or Seventh Circuit precedent that deals with this pattern, which is going to be the pattern from now on, given Hoosier Bank Corporation. In terms of the second question that I understood Your Honor to ask, you know, what plain reading of the statute would apply here, and it's the reading that we have proposed, and that is that claims are different from actions, and that's true in lots of different contexts, and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and statutes throughout the statute books. But most importantly, those words are both used not only in the statute at issue, but in the sentence that we're looking at in the judgment bar of 2676. And 2676 talks about a judgment on a Federal Torts Claim Act action barring another action that's based on the same action. Fact. I'm sorry?
Another action, which makes the first one an action before there can be another action. And you're into your rebuttal time, but you go ahead and share.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
I see you're into your rebuttal time, but to say another implies the existence of an action to get to the second action, or there wouldn't be another action.
You would need an act. You couldn't be barring the same action that the Federal Torts Claim Act is a part of. That wouldn't make any sense.
What I'm saying is claim and action mean the same thing, isn't it?
No, I disagree with that
respect. You may disagree with it, but why would there be another if there wasn't a first?
Well, because you could have the concern of 2676 is, as the Supreme Court has held and as this Court has held, is principally with relitigation. It's with duplicative litigation. And so if you're talking about barring a different action, then what you're doing is you're vindicating the statutory purpose of not relitigating and duplicative litigation. But if you're talking about bringing claims in the same action and allowing those claims to be resolved, as this Court said in Hoosier Bank Corp., that takes care of the concern with duplicative litigation. And I am into my rebuttal time, so I'll sit down for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. And Mr. Walsh?
May it please the Court, Counsel. As you know, we're splitting our argument, Your Honors. I will address the main appeal only, the judgment bar issue, and Mr. Hale will address our conditional cross-appeal. Congress enacted the Federal Tort Claims Act in 1946 after an Army B-25 bomber crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building, killing a bunch of people and setting the building on fire. Different versions of the Federal Tort Claims Act had been proposed over the years, but that actually got Congress moving. When Congress did waive our nation's sovereign immunity in tort cases, it did so on the condition that in a one-sentence section that bars any action against a federal employee arising out of the same subject matter as the FTCA case if you get a judgment in the FTCA case. And there are no ifs, ands, or buts in that section. Nothing in that simple sentence gives even a hint that the order of the judgment matters, that who won the FTCA case matters, or whether the cases are brought together or sequentially matters. It's a very simple one-sentence section. It couldn't be more categorical, and virtually every attempt to read conditions into the judgment bar that aren't written in it have been rejected by appellate courts throughout the nation, including this court in its only published decision on the subject. The district court noted properly that Section 2676 expressly imposes a bar to any action and not just to subsequent actions. I never thought I'd be up here spouting the wisdom of Judge Julius Hoffman, but as he might say, this statute is so simple that even a first-year Knight Law student could understand it. I used to take more offense at that when I was much closer to being a first-year Knight Law student. Mr. Beck led his argument with the notion that he couldn't voluntarily withdraw his FTCA claim and thereby avoid the judgment bar. And I think he needs that argument to make the judgment bar section seem so harsh that you wouldn't want to apply it. First of all, if it were that harsh, you'd still have to apply it because that would be the law. But it isn't that harsh. It actually gives people a choice. It gives litigants a choice. The notion that you couldn't voluntarily withdraw your FTCA claim before going to judgment is just not supported in the text. You know, there is some issue in about what is the triggering event with the with Section 2676. Of course, it is a judgment in an FTCA case, and there's some issue about what did Congress mean by that. That's not an issue in our case because we have the paradigm of a judgment. We have a judgment after a trial. The Supreme Court almost considered a case recently, Will versus Halleck, raising the issue of whether a decision on the merits, but if it's a decision that is based on lack of jurisdiction, is that a judgment that triggers the judgment bar? This court has said no. Most courts have said no. The Second Circuit said that that the judgment bar is not triggered by anything other than a judgment on the merits, and that a dismissal on jurisdictional grounds doesn't trigger it. Anyhow, I'm probably getting too deep into that. We don't have to reach that because that's not an issue in this case. As I said, we have a judgment after a trial. In any event, all the cases that suggest or hold or encourage people to bring both their FTCA and Bivens cases together in one action would be wrong if, in fact, you couldn't withdraw your FTCA claim before going to judgment. It would make no sense to encourage parties to bring their cases together and then at some point choose which one to go forward on. Otherwise, cases would be dismissed as soon as somebody filed their FTCA case, and we're not arguing that's the case. As a matter of fact, in this very case, Mr. Manning brought an FTCA case that he later voluntarily withdrew or voluntarily dismissed because he hadn't exhausted his administrative remedies. We didn't argue that that triggered the judgment bar. What triggered the judgment bar here is the judgment after a trial. The other reason you should take that argument with a grain of salt is that Mr. Manning argued himself twice to the district court that he could voluntarily withdraw his claim and thereby avoid the judgment bar. Now, by the time he did that, it was too late. He already had a decision in his FTCA case, and the district court wouldn't let him undo a strategic decision that he'd already made. But he argued twice that it was okay. Not only that it was okay, he cited cases, and he assured the district court that if it did allow him to voluntarily withdraw his claim without prejudice, that would be subject only to deferential review on appeal. There's also the element of sort of unfairness that creeps into this. I think part of the argument is that, you know, poor Mr. Manning, he didn't, you know, he got tricked into doing this or something like that. He knew from the start that I'm sure that you may have read this in our briefs, but the district court originally set the trial on the FTCA case to go prior to the Bivens case. And when the district court was reminded of the possibility that the judgment bar would be triggered by that, he immediately vacated his order setting the trial separately and instead set the trials to be held together. So Mr. Manning knew before the trial started about the judgment bar. He knew after the trials were held, after he had a Bivens verdict in hand, and then he had a year and a half or more to voluntarily withdraw his FTCA case, and he didn't. What I gather from plaintiff's argument here is that they just don't like the way this turns out, and they would like you to rewrite it. And one of the things that they point to, instead of the words in the statute, which is where this analysis should begin and can probably end, is they point to the legislative history, the supposed reasons for having the judgment bar in the first place. And everybody talks about the fact that one of the reasons for having the judgment bar is to prevent dual recoveries. Okay, that might be one of the reasons why you would have it. But there's really no good support for that. I think you're still stuck with just looking at the language of the statute itself. You must hew to the unambiguous text of the statute unless the result is absurd, which it's not. And nothing in the text says it shouldn't apply if the issue of dual recoveries is not an issue in any one particular case. And speaking of legislative history, there's really not very good legislative history in the first place. The legislative history that Mr. Manning cites, and concededly some courts cite as well, is a legislative history of an earlier Congress than the one that actually passed the Federal Tort Claims Act. There doesn't seem to be any available legislative history on the act that was actually passed. Not only that, the language from that legislative history that is cited is the statement of an executive branch official who was testifying in favor of the bill that was before that Congress. And one of the reasons he did give was to avoid dual recoveries, but it was just one of several reasons. There's also the more obvious reason, which is this is designed to keep up the morale of the federal workforce. This is all the more true considering subsequent legislative developments. When the Federal Tort Claims Act was passed in 1946, there weren't Bivens cases. No such thing. The only kinds of claims that Congress was concerned about at that time were common law tort claims. Bivens, of course, wasn't decided until 1971. So before you start thinking,
if the judgment had come back, if the FTCA case in this case had come back with, say, $20,000, would that have overridden the Bivens action?
Yeah, there are numerous cases. I shouldn't say numerous. There are several cases that are cited in our brief.
It would be the same result. It would just be a slight judgment.
What it comes down to is you get the result. If you go to judgment in an FTCA case, you get the result in the FTCA case. It bars any judgment in any other action against the employees for conduct growing out of that same transaction. So if you got $20,000, you get $20,000. If you get zero, as Mr. Manning got in this case, that's what he gets, the result of the FTCA case. When Congress did amend the FTCA, its most significant amendments was in 1988 when they passed the Westfall Act amendments. And at that point, they granted absolute immunity to federal employees acting within the scope of their employment for common law torts. At the same time, they specifically accepted from that grant of absolute immunity Bivens claims. But at the same time, they left the judgment bar, Section 2676, intact. And the only reason to leave it there is for Bivens claims. So it seems to me pretty clear when you look at the statute that it's designed to protect federal employees. It isn't concerned just with dual recoveries or making sure cases get tried together or helping the courts save their dockets by having more efficient trials. The purpose of Section 2676 is to protect federal employees, to protect them from exposure to personal financial ruin, and make sure that they're not uncertain and intimidated in the performance of their official duties. I noticed that when you asked Mr. Beck where in the text, where in the plain meaning of the statute, you might be able to find some evidence that that he wasn't putting his claim at risk when he went to trial and went to judgment on the FTCA case, despite having plenty of opportunity to voluntarily withdraw his claim. Instead of talking about the statute, he started talking about the cases. And I think that's a mistake, just to try and find from snippets of dicta and statements taken out of context some support. The only thing that he eventually got around to was this notion that a claim and a judgment, or a claim and an action, are different
things.
Excuse me, Aaron?
Mean two different things.
That's yes. And an action is much broader. I don't want to run over too much time on my opponent, but let me finish. I think the text of the statute is clear. What the Seventh Circuit referred to as over 50 years of consistent case law on this subject. The district court had no choice here but to apply the judgment bar. So unless the court has further questions of me, I ask you to affirm the district court's judgment bar decision. And I'll turn the podium over to my colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Hale?
May it please the court, counsel. Our cross appeal argues that the jury verdict should be reversed because of insufficient evidence or because of absolute or qualified immunity. We were here before you at the beginning of this case on the immunity issue, and this court issued an opinion listing four things that Manning might be able to prove after discovery in a trial to avoid immunity. He had the trial, and he didn't deliver on any of the four things this court cited in its opinion. And I'd like to go through those if I have time, but because my time's short, I'd like to make sure I do two things during my argument. And that is, one, articulate the central premise of our cross-appeal and give you one example of it. The main argument in our cross-appeal is that the evidence in this case can't support a rational jury finding that the criminal trial witnesses lied. And much less can it support a finding that the agents somehow induced the witnesses to lie. In this case, there wasn't any material new evidence presented in the civil case. None of the criminal trial witnesses recanted or changed their testimony. Several of them testified at the civil trial, and they reaffirmed their testimony. The vast majority of the evidence that Manning relies on proved that the criminal trial witnesses were lying consisted of inconsistent statements and other purported anomalies that the agents themselves collected and documented and disclosed as per Brady at the beginning. And you know, our argument is that the most that that evidence can do is go to the reliability of the testimony of the criminal trial witnesses. In fact, it doesn't even go too far to that. After all, it's the same evidence which the criminal juries heard and found Manning guilty beyond a reasonable doubt on. And a skeptical district court judge in this case also believed the witnesses and thought Manning was probably guilty. So that evidence is not enough to prove with any degree of confidence that the criminal trial witnesses lied. And even if this court were to disagree on that, it certainly is not enough to take the next step and prove rationally that the agents somehow induced the witnesses to lie. You know, otherwise, agents can be liable in any case where there's a conviction that's reversed. I'd like to give one example, and that's Sharon Dugan. She was the ex-wife of Manning's accomplice in the Missouri kidnapping robbery, Gary Engel. She told how Manning and her husband went down to Missouri to do the robbery kidnapping and brought her back a ring that they got from one of the kidnappers. Now, she testified in the civil case here to the same thing that she testified to in the criminal trial. She didn't change her story at all. But the civil jury in this case found that she lied and that the agents had induced her to lie. Well, what did the evidence show? The evidence, the only evidence that she was lying, was evidence that when she was first interviewed by the local police, she didn't tell them about Manning's involvement. And it was when she was interviewed by the FBI that she told about Manning's involvement in the robbery kidnapping. Well, that's not evidence that she lied. In the first place, as the district court found, it wasn't even evidence that she was asked in the first interview. And the district court found there was no significant inconsistency. But even if there is an inconsistency, it's not proof that she was lying. She had a very good explanation for not telling the local police about Manning. She didn't trust the local police. Her husband was a local cop. Manning was a local cop. And she knew they were in a burglary ring with other local cops. And so that's why she wouldn't want to tell a local cop about that. That evidence, it doesn't even prove, it's not even a good reason to doubt the reliability of her testimony. It's certainly not enough to prove she was lying, and all the more not enough to prove that Agent Buchan somehow induced her to lie. You know, but there really shouldn't have to even be an explanation. Agent Buchan should have immunity for writing down in his report what the witness told him, and an officer shouldn't be worried when he does a witness interview, that if the witness tells him something more than she's told police officers previously, that he can be on the hook for $6 million. And plus, this is a Brady claim, and if there's a discrepancy, that was turned over as per Brady. So that's basically a microcosm of what happened in this case. To go back to this court's opinion, this court listed four things Manning might be able to prove, and he didn't come through on any of them. First, that they even said destroyed or tampered with tape recordings. Well, that was specifically rejected by the jury. Next, that the agents selected Dye to be the jailhouse informant because they knew that he was a good liar and would lie for him, and then they fed him facts to enable him to lie effectively. Well, the evidence didn't prove any of those things, and the jury didn't find him. The evidence showed that the agents had no prior knowledge of Dye. The evidence showed they didn't select him. It was Miles Cooperman at the Cook County Jail that selected him, and the first agent to meet with him was Tom Gancars, who's not a defendant in the case. And the jury didn't find, and the evidence didn't show, that the agents fed Dye any facts. What the evidence showed was that Manning gave Dye facts, and Dye told those facts to the agents, and they wrote down what Dye told them, even when it was inconsistent with the known physical evidence. So, for example, Dye told him that Manning said that Pellegrino was shot twice in the head, and they wrote that down, even though the physical evidence showed he was only shot once in the head. And Dye told him Manning said that chemicals were used to help decompose the body, and they wrote that down, even though there was no evidence of that. And then they turned that over. That was helpful to Manning, and they turned that over as per Brady. And that's certainly not the agents feeding Dye facts. That's the agents writing down things that Dye told him, even when they knew it would help Manning and it wouldn't help the criminal case. Next, this court cited Manning's allegations that the defendants had induced Heldenbrand to falsely identify him in a photo lineup. Well, there was a photo lineup. You could argue it was suggestive, but the circumstances of that photo lineup were all disclosed, and that couldn't be a Brady violation, as this court held in Newsom. And there was no evidence at all to support Manning's claim that there was something else that happened. Their own expert testified that he hadn't seen anything that indicated Agent Buchan misrepresented what he did to the prosecutors. And finally, the court cited Manning's allegation about false reports, but there's no proof of that. In fact, the agents relied on the accuracy, or the Manning relied on the accuracy of the reports to prove his allegation that the criminal witnesses were lying. So none of the criminal trial witnesses changed their testimony. The few new things that were presented were not material, as we set forth in our brief. The evidence was not enough to support a rational finding that the criminal trial witnesses lied, and certainly in any event wasn't enough to support an additional finding that these agents somehow induced them to lie.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Beck.
Mr. Walsh said, and the district court did as well, that applying 2676, when we have two claims brought in a single cause of action, won't extinguish the Bivens action because the plaintiff can always withdraw the FTCA claim before it comes to judgment. That cannot be correct. It is not correct. And it cannot support their statutory interpretation. There is no right to withdraw a claim that has been fully discovered, that has been tried to the judge, and that is awaiting decision. A withdrawal of such a claim at that point would necessarily be with prejudice, and it would act as a judgment, and it would trigger the judgment bar. So even then, the Bivens claim would be extinguished. Now, the district court said, well, if Mr. Manning had asked me to, I likely would have exercised my discretion to grant a dismissal without prejudice. That, if he in fact had done that, it would have departed from settled Seventh Circuit precedent, which says that you can't grant a dismissal without prejudice when it would severely prejudice the party on the other side. And here...
But you could have dismissed the Federal Tort Claim Act before the trial started.
Well, I'm not sure that once you go all the way through discovery and you're on the eve of trial, that you can do that.
Why not?
I'm sorry?
Is there authority for the position you have just taken? And you cannot dismiss it once you've gone through discovery.
There is no authority for the proposition that you have a right to withdraw your claim and automatically get a dismissal without prejudice.
Say without prejudice, but you could dismiss it.
Oh, but with prejudice means that it's a judgment against you and triggers the judgment bar. So my point, Your Honor, is that...
So you think that to take the position of the government, you'd have to make the decision before you filed any claim at all and decide which trigger.
And that is absolutely precluded by United States Supreme Court precedent, where the United States Supreme Court has held that 2676 is not an election of remedies statute that requires you to choose one claim versus the other.
Didn't say require. You said it's absolutely forbidden.
I'm sorry?
You said it was forbidden. I see. Now you said that you can't require that.
The construction that says, well, 2676 requires you to elect at the commencement of the litigation, that construction of 2676 is forbidden by the United States Supreme Court that says you're entitled to pursue both claims at once.
Ms. Beck, I'd like to ask you just one additional question. Discovery took some time in this case. Is your position that this is a discovery on both claims at the same time?
It was discovery on both claims at the same time, yes.
Could we have a situation where you file a Bivens claim and have the extensive discovery that took place over a substantial period of time here, and then make a decision on the Tort Claims Act?
I suppose you could, Your Honor, and you could also have a situation where, notwithstanding Hoosier Bank Corporation, if this construction stands, what a plaintiff actually would do is say, forget about Hoosier Bank Corporation. I'm going to bring my Bivens action as soon as I possibly can. I'm going to wait 2 years on the Federal Tort Claim Act, and then I'm going to file my administrative claim. I'm going to string that out as long as I can. And then when they deny that, I'm going to wait till the absolute last minute before I file a Federal Tort Claim action in the hope that I can get my Bivens claim decided first. Mm-hmm. That is going to be the practical consequence of this statutory construction from the district judge, and it's exactly opposite of what this court said should be done, which is they ought to be brought together, and that is the way to solve the problem of duplicative litigation. And if they are brought together, the judgment bar doesn't apply because it applies to actions rather than claims, and meanwhile, the purposes of the statute are vindicated.
Yeah, the discovery in a Bivens action gives one an indication sometimes of the potential for recovery, how deep the pocket is, right?
Right. So, yeah, it does.
What I'm suggesting is that course can be followed, and I understand you talk about the back end of having then to bring the Tort Claims Act. I assume discovery would be relatively short in that second inquiry claim.
What we have here is the plaintiff would have an overwhelming incentive to go fast on Bivens and slowboat the Federal Tort Claim Act so that there wouldn't be a judgment there that would nullify a Bivens judgment. Meanwhile, the government would have the opposite incentive, which is to speed up the Federal Tort Claim Act and get a judgment pro or con there and knock out the Bivens claim.
I appreciate that logic. I really do see where you're coming from on that. How does that balance, if at all, with Mr. Walsh's suggestion of what really was behind Congress's intent in effect protecting employees from their conduct by having the pocket of the government available? I mean, is that a competing or just a totally separate analysis?
I think the cases recognize that the principal concern is duplicative litigation. And then Mr. Walsh argues that...
What do they mean by duplicative? Is it duplicative just in the sense of the resources of a court, or is it duplicative in the sense that Mr. Walsh is suggesting that there's this overriding congressional intent to insulate federal employees?
It's the resources of the court as well as the resources of the government and not having to have their agents and their lawyers try similar cases twice. But, Your Honor, in terms of the interests of employees and not being subject to liability, the United States Supreme Court has said, no, that doesn't trump a Bivens action.
I didn't mean to suggest an attempt to preclude Bivens actions, but there must be some interest by the federal government in its decision to waive the...
I think that there is some interest there, and they're saying that by waiving sovereign immunity, we, although not for Bivens claims, incidentally, but by waiving sovereign immunity, we're going to basically take the employees off the hook individually and stand behind them. So that interest is clearly at stake, but that interest doesn't mean that the judgment bar should be construed in such a way where, except in the most bizarre circumstances, a Bivens action is automatically going to be extinguished. Under the district court's interpretation, the only time a Bivens action survives, if a plaintiff does what this court says he should do, is if you happen to get a Bivens judgment first, and if the district court happens to exercise his discretion to grant a dismissal without prejudice rather than with prejudice, and if this court happens to affirm that dismissal without prejudice was appropriate, notwithstanding the clear prejudice that would occur to the agents in that circumstance. And we submit that sort of very unique set of circumstances should not drive the interpretation of the statute. The statute ought to be interpreted in light of what is going to be the typical situation, not that peculiar one.
Thank you for your patience. Thanks, Mr. Walsh. Thanks to all, and Mr. Hale. Thanks to all other counsel. The case is taken under advisement.